Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter. At 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we begin our weekly look at the justice system and what it means to you. We begin with a discussion about the bail bond system and how reforming it might look. How does it work? Is it fair for people of color? Well, joining me to talk about this are Jeffrey Clayton, Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition, and Antoine Washington, owner of Washington and Gray Bail Bonds in the D.C. Metro. Join the conversation at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Antoine and Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey, can you hear me?
I can. Thank you for having me.
Okay, let me first kind of get an understanding of how bail bonds work, Antoine. If your regular Joe guy gets arrested for, say, DUI, and he hits somebody, he hurts someone, not necessarily killing them, but certainly damages his car, and their body. What happens next if they get arrested and they go to jail?
Well, like you said, he's been arrested. So he, in the state of Maryland, they call it, he'll go before a district court commissioner.
Okay.
In Virginia, they're known as magistrates, right? So he's, if it's happening in Prince George's County, he goes in front of the district court commissioner and they will assess his risk level, his probability of not returning to court.
Okay? How do you assess someone's risk level?
Well, the first thing you look at is, I'm not a district court commissioner, by the way, but
certainly.
I've just been doing it long to get the mindset.
More than 20 years.
Right. You go to the criminal record first. You see what this person's been charged with. See, is his first time, his second time, his third time? Does he work? Is he married? Has he graduated high school? It's just factors that you go through to try to assess someone.
So let's assume that he is given a $50,000 bond.
Okay.
Does he have to come up with $50,000?
Well, he has options. His first option, he can, if he has $50,000, he can go right to the court and pay $50,000 in property or cash.
Okay.
That's his right. If he does not have the $50,000, that's when he needs to contact someone like myself, bail bondsman. We charge a 10% non-refundable fee. If you do not have the 10% of $50,000 is $5,000, by the way.
Okay.
You'll contact the bondsman. Hopefully it's me, right? You come into my office, you'll pay 10% fee with $5,000.
So he gives you $5,000.
Of course.
What do you do with that $5,000?
The $5,000 is considered a premium to me, right? Then in turn, I pledge the $50,000 to the court for his release. And by me pledging the $50,000 to the court, I'm saying to the court, I'm going to guarantee that John Doe makes each and every court day a schedule.
If he decides, after thinking about it, that he decides to, as they say, skip bail.
Right.
What happens to, if he's a no-show in court, what kind of situation does that put you in?
Well, what happens, the bail bond term for that is bail bond forfeiture.
Okay.
They forfeit the bail. I'll get notice saying John Doe didn't appear for court, right? In that moment, I get on the phone with whoever paid me the $5,000, a wife, a neighbor, a boss, whoever.
Wherever
the money came from. As a courtesy, I call this person and say, hey, this is Antoine Washington. I'm your bail bonds. I'm sure you remember me. John Doe didn't make it to court. I need to know where he is and if you can help me locate him. So at that point, that's when it go either to the left or to the right. That person can either cooperate with me in locating them, or they can be uncooperative. And that's when you hear about bounty hunters and future recovery agents and things like that. But I have a prescribed amount of time to either locate the defendant or pay the $50,000.
Mm-hmm. But before I go to Jeffrey, I do have another question, because we often hear, and I think you touched on it, You may not be able to reach John Doe, but you can reach John Doe's wife. You may be able to reach his grandmother or his uncle. And sometimes people don't put up cash. They may have to explain how some people put up the homes that they own in order to make the bond.
Well, that's, I wouldn't say that's a myth, but you don't actually put up your home with a bail bondsman. The only, in order to pledge your home for the release of someone, you pledge your home with the court.
Okay.
Like you can use your home with me as collateral. Like you can sign like a deed of trust, or you can sign like a confessed judgment. This is contingent. If the person doesn't show for court, then your home, you know, comes into play. But to actually truly put up your home as a, to get someone released from jail, you wouldn't do that with me. You'd do it with the court. And then the court would, you know, place a lien on your home, and,
wow,
and you won't have to use a bail bond. You cut me completely out.
Mm-hmm.
But if grandma owned a house for 25 years and she didn't want to pledge her home with the court, she could come in my office and say, look, I'll sign all the paperwork necessary, and I'll use my home as collateral in the event that John Doe doesn't show for court. Then I could lien her home. Then once I lien her home, I can force action.
Right.
If the bond defaults.
Yeah, so that's a rather difficult situation. Mm-hmm. We are talking about the bail bond system and reform. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jeffrey, let me come to you. You believe that the bail bond system is broken. Why?
Well, I don't think it's completely broken, but it certainly needs a lot of improving. I think lawyers and practitioners for years have taken bail as a given. They never think about it. We have very little individual consideration of people's rights. A lot of quick decisions are made without a lot of input, and we've seen a rash of lawsuits on that issue. The other thing I think that we're seeing and that I think is a problem is using a lot of bail in a lot of low-level cases. Legislation was passed in New Hampshire to end the use of bail on non-jailable offenses, meaning offenses for which jail was never a potential penalty. They were still arresting people, and people were still sitting in jail on a $200 bail. That's just stupid. So, you know, there are significant changes that need to be made, but on the whole, I think the system works fairly well.
Mm-hmm. Some have argued, including organizations like the NAACP, the ACLU, and others, that the bail system discriminates against people of color. There was a case just last week in Ferguson that was recounted on the fourth anniversary of the death of Michael Brown, where a mother talked about her son going to jail in Ferguson, Missouri, in that jurisdiction for a low-level crime, could not make bail. During the time that he was in jail, he was murdered. And she spoke about the need there for bail reform. And in another case, as we have seen just this week, a man who was accused of setting the mother of his child on fire, is being released. Do you believe, Antoine, that the system is unfair for people of color, and what determines whether it is or is not, in your opinion?
Yes, I do. I have seen firsthand people of color with the same charge as white,
uh-huh,
be held without bond, extremely high bonds, bails, and with our white brother,
a white dependent,
right,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. He gets released for the same exact thing. I see a 21-year-old black kid get arrested for possession of weed and a firearm. He gets a bail, maybe a $5,000 bond, needs $500. I see a white kid, possession of weed, firearm. He gets released with just a court date. I see it every day.
Jeffrey, your thoughts about that and the difference that we have seen, not just here but across the country, when you're talking about bail for people of color and white folks.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue, and I've certainly seen the issue. And don't get me started on Ferguson. I mean, they started the reforms there over the last year have increased pretrial incarceration by 21%. And I think that's really what's going on right now, is we're using these computerized risk assessment tools to essentially confirm what we think should be true, which is that, oh, African Americans should always be overrepresented and should always be higher risk. And that's what we have going on. And we, you know, and I think the entire system is broken from that perspective. We over arrest African American defendants. That's been true. I think that's just a legacy of the incidents and badges of slavery. And if we don't get serious and think bigger, we're never going to solve it.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the bail bond system and reforming it. What does that look like? If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. Let me go to Israel. Israel calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, how y'all doing this evening?
Doing just fine.
How you doing?
I just want to know the criteria on becoming a bail bondsman. Like what would one have to do to become a bail bondsman?
Well, number one, you would need a property and casualty license. That's the first step. Because most bail bond agents are insurance agents, right? So you get a property and casualty license. Then at that point, you have to find employment on your own. You have to, once you have the license, then that's the starting point to even getting a conversation or a sit down with a professional bail bondsman.
But I would imagine also that it's not as, I mean, you've been doing it for 20 years, and it is not an easy thing, because in a great many cases you may be dealing with people who may have first time experiences with the justice system, but then you may have some people
right.
who have been in the justice system for a really, really long
exactly.
time.
Exactly. Exactly. You couldn't have put it better. Quick story. I bonded a guy one time I bonded him out on a traffic ticket, right? He was charged with suspended license, right? That's all I knew. When he made bail, we posted bond for him. He got out, and when I called him for his court date, he said, okay, I have no problem. He was a complete gentleman. He went to court, got the case, just charges dropped, right? So when I went further into his criminal history, he did like 25 years for murder. Mm-hmm. He just had a suspended license because he was in jail. But if he would have missed court, and I'm just thinking I'm going to get to knock on someone's door that had a suspended driver's license, this guy's 25 years in.
Yeah, so then some people are dangerous.
Right, right. So you can't. This is a job that is a very serious job. It's very serious. You're dealing with people who are hiding. Some people who are dangerous, some people who are, just lawbreakers. And you got to be prepared. I mean, yeah, like I told the gentleman who called, a property and casualty license, yeah, that starts the process to become a bail bondsman. But it's much, much, much more that I can't even, you would actually have to sit for me for hours to explain to you.
Because I'm sure you've got stories to tell.
Right, right.
Thank you so much, Israel. Jeffrey, talk to me a little bit about this computer algorithm that addresses risk assessment. Break that down for me, please.
Sure. So the posited alternative to the current system is we'll run people through a computer, and we'll predict how likely it is they're going to commit a new crime or fail to appear in court. The largest proprietor of these in bail is an outfit called the Laura and John Arnold Foundation. John Arnold was with Enron, got out before the collapse, and now he's, quote-unquote, going to moneyball criminal justice. The way it works generally is a lot of mathematics are done to basically determine what factors these folks think are predictive. And then based on that, the computer spits out a score and then makes a recommendation as to, in many cases, what the bail should be and also what the other conditions should be, such as whether somebody gets an ankle monitor or they're on house arrest. And so these have been around for a while, but the movement is really, really focused on the use of these computer tools.
How much flexibility does a judge have in applying a dollar amount to bond?
You know, it depends on the state. Some states have statutory bonds. In other words, the legislature has set a bond for a particular offense and the court doesn't have jurisdiction. In most cases, judges have wide jurisdiction to set bonds as they see appropriate, with the caveat, of course, that they can't be excessive bail under state and federal constitutions.
What is excessive bail? I'll let you answer that on the other side, because that just kind of popped up in my head. And that's a question, I think, for both Jeffrey and Antoine. Lines are still open. Want to hear from you. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. After the break, we're going to hear from Dwayne calling from Baltimore. So lines are still open. Give us a call. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Your phone calls are next.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're discussing the bail bond system and how to reform it, what that may look like. This is the beginning of our weekly look at the justice system and what it means to you. My guests are Jeffrey Clayton, Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition, and Antoine Washington, owner of Washington and Gray Bail Bonds here in the D.C. Metro. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before the break, Jeffrey, I asked, what is excessive bail and who determines what that is?
Exactly. Excessive bail has been around largely, well, the entire time Europeans have been on this continent, we've used this standard. Really what it means is impose too high of a bail than is necessary to guarantee someone's appearance in court. And there's factors to consider, and each state has different factors. And really, it's just an argument that a defense counsel will make. And one of the famous cases on this came out of New York State, where a guy who was homeless and unemployed was charged with first-degree murder. The judge set his bail at $10,000. He filed for an excessive bail. The judge says it wasn't excessive. And the community went crazy and said, that's wrong, that's terrible. But the point was, is that was the appropriate and necessary amount of bail in that judge's view, and the Court of Appeals agreed with him in a first-degree murder case. So it should be flexible, and it should be based on the facts and the circumstances of each case. And the judges are tasked in each case with deciding those motions.
Antoine, have you ever been in a situation where someone was given what you would consider an excessive bail, and they appealed it and had it reduced? And if so, how does that work?
Yes. When you're arrested, you have within 24 hours, in Prince George County, Maryland, and in the state of Maryland as a whole, once you see the district court commissioner, if your bail is too high or if you feel like it's excessive, you'll have what they call a bail hearing the next day. You go before a judge. The judge, he'll look at your bail that the district court commissioner gave you, and he or she, the judge, will determine if that bond was fair. They don't really get into the specifics of the charge, but they kind of, they definitely get into specifics of who you are. You know, like where you live, where you work, who's in court for you. And then they'll adjust the bond. If your bond was, say, $50,000 set by the district court commissioner, if the judge felt that I was too high of a bond, at that point, he can reduce it, he can leave it the same, or he can just let you go on your own personal recognizance. They review the bonds each day, basically.
Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dwayne, calling from Baltimore. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
My name's Dwayne Davis. I'm a prisoner's right advocate here in the state of Maryland.
Yes, sir.
And in Illinois. I do a lot of advocacy in Annapolis as far as the bail bonds industry and prisoner's rights. Now, the bail bonds industry in itself is structured on a racial structure. They're slave catchers.
Why do you say that?
Because when we were slaves, we traded the penitentiary for the plantation, cotton for cocaine, and we the cash crop. Those algorithms that you talk about,
yes, sir,
are also incorporated with your kids that go to school and their zip codes, the zip code racism. That all ties together. That's the cradle of prison pipeline. So y'all already picking the people that's going to go to jail. You understand? The dissent decree in Baltimore City deals with a lot of that bail, the bonds, the false imprisonments in the jails. You understand what I'm saying? So that all tied together. And the bail industry in the state of Maryland is one of the highest lobbyists in the state. You understand what I'm saying? You can Google me. You can Google my case. You can Google the things that I'm saying. And right now, the Department of Justice, I asked the Department of Justice to investigate the courts of Baltimore City and Baltimore County because it's racketeering. And they're racketeering. They're profiting off of it. And their surety bonds are tied to it.
Well, Dwayne, let me stop you there, and thank you for calling, because I think there's a bigger issue here, and I think you brought up a really critical issue. You talked about the dissent decree that had to do with the Baltimore City Police. I think the bottom line is, whether you're talking about Baltimore City, whether you're talking about Ferguson and the Ferguson Commission, Jeffrey, the reality is that there are difficult questions about equity, and earlier you said, don't get you started on Ferguson. Please start on Ferguson or Baltimore, because as was reported just last week, that's 4 years after the killing of Michael Brown, only about four or five of the reforms in the Ferguson Commission have out of 47 recommendations have been instituted.
Well, I think it's an insult to say that we're going to spend $3 million of grant money and we're going to increase the pretrial population by 21% in 1 year in Ferguson. Something went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an insult to everybody that went through Ferguson. That's an insult to everybody. Same thing in Baltimore when the Supreme Court said, hey, we're going to get rid of bail. Well, what happened? Judges locked everybody up. So, you know, from my perspective, I think it's fair to say we over-arrest African-American defendants, and we've got to get to the part of the problem. My fear is the answer is more of the same. We have to break the generational issues that have been going on since 1970, and we, for some reason or another, we can't seem to do it.
But be more specific when you say generational issues since 1970.
Yeah, I think a great article written by Professor Robert Worth from Rice University talks about the modern creation of the penal state and the idea that we're going to basically put a scarlet letter on people using these risk computers. And we're just going to treat people based on that number. We're not going to treat them as individuals. And we've dramatically widened the net on people since 1970. You know, you got to keep in mind, there was very little probation or parole prior to 1970. You paid your time, you paid your dues, and you were done. And now what we have is you do your time, and you're on probation, and you're re-ensnared. And the other thing is, after years of going through the system, you can never reduce your risk. You're always riskier than somebody else, even if you lick the drug problem. Even if you fix the things that are causing you to commit crimes, there's no remorse. And that system is doomed to fail. And unfortunately, African Americans have been overrepresented in that system, dooming them to fail generationally in a way that we need to undo.
Antoine, you were kind of nodding your head.
Yeah, I agree with him 100%. 100%. Listen, people get arrested every day. Who? District court commissioners, judges, people assess their risk level, and are they going to return to court? Are they going to repeat the same crime? Come on.
But is it? Do you think that the algorithm is worse than the judgment of a magistrate judge? Or because I mean, it seems to me that all of this would be subjective.
It is. If you judges are people, you know, you have a judge that had a great vacation before he came back on the bench, or he had a horrible night. He didn't get a great night's sleep, and then he's in front of some defendant that
had a DUI.
Yeah. And the judge said, "Well, since I had a terrible night's sleep, $50,000 bond." Or if he had a coming off a great vacation, the same guy may get released with just a court date. It's all subjective. And it's sad. I see it every single day. Like, every day I see this.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Loretta, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling, Loretta. What's on your mind?
Hi, I just wanted to say, Antoine, this is Loretta.
Hi, Loretta.
The conversation that you are having is well needed. You know that.
Yeah.
You know, we all fight.
Yep.
So I just wanted to just comment that this is a very important conversation, and I will be listening to the whole show.
This is Miss Loretta Cole. This is Miss Loretta Cole. She's one of the biggest bail bond companies in the entire state.
Oh, I see. So with that, so since I have you on, Loretta, what do you believe is the answer to reforming bail bonds? I'll give you 30 seconds or so to speak your piece.
Well, I mean, as far as reform, wow, there's so many things I could get into. I just kind of caught me at a moment. I just heard it, so I just decided I would call.
But do you think? What do you think if you could wave your bail bondsman magic wand and reform the system? What would be the top thing that you would suggest?
Well, Antoine, you said it pretty clearly. It's just the one sidedness of the bonds them giving the black folks higher bonds than they give, the Caucasian, defendants with the same crimes. Mm-hmm. I think everything should be even, and should be an even playing field.
Exactly.
I see.
That's all we're looking for, this equality.
I see.
Right.
Loretta, thank you so much for listening.
I appreciate
your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Joe, calling from Maryland. What's on your mind, Joe? Joe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
So what's on your mind? Go right ahead.
I have a question.
Sure.
If you happen to get into the system, you pay your bond, which is the 10%, and then you find out, you go to court, and the charges are dropped, don't you think it's logical that you should be refunded that 10%?
That's a great question. So how does that work?
Some bills, when you pay the court direct, when the bondsman is not involved and you pay the court 10%, when the case is finished, yeah, you get your 10% back. But when you go through a bail bondsman, the fees are never refunded.
So the court wouldn't refund you with?
Well, some bonds are 10% bonds payable to the court,
mm-hmm.
and some bonds are 100%. I mean, you have the 100%. I mean, they want 100% of the bond. If it's a $2,000 bond, the court, before you get released, they want $2,000. So you don't have the option to pay the court. You have to pay the bail bondsman if it's a 100% bond. Now, if it's $2,000 bond, 10% to the court, then you take the $200, you go to the court, you pay the court, the case gets dismissed or finished or however the outcome. Once the case is done, you'll get your 10% back. But anytime you pay a bail bond, the money is non-returnable.
Okay. Joe, thank you so much for your phone call. Jeffrey, what is preventative detention?
Well, preventative detention is what the government uses to detain people and not offer any release or bail. In other words, we're locking you up the entire pendency of trial or until you plead guilty. And there's a couple of states that allow that fairly expansively. Washington, D.C. is one, the district. New Jersey, the federal system, and New Mexico are kind of the primary, and I would probably say Maryland at this point, are probably the systems that use it the most.
Mm-hmm. But here's the question, though. I know we had a big discussion about equity and fairness, but isn't it true that there are just some cases where there needs to be a very, very high bond when you have someone that is accused of a heinous crime? And this is for Jeffrey, because some people who may have been accused of a heinous crime, even with a high bond, with a good attorney or something else, sometimes they make bail, they come out, and while they're awaiting trial, they still commit more crime.
Yeah, that's a problem, but that's the justice system. That's our American tradition, which is we are not going to give the government the power to lock people up. And the reason we aren't is because look at through history. If we just gave willy-nilly the power of the government to lock people up, the wind could blow, things could change at the Capitol, and all of a sudden political enemies are locked up. Example, do you want to give Donald Trump the power to preventatively detain people? Which he has. I don't think anybody's going to argue that that's a good idea. But that's what we have right now, and that's the system in the federal system. So I think high bonds are the way it was handled under the old system. And if you can secure your release, so be it. But that strikes a balance better than giving the state and prosecutors the power to just simply lock people up and throw away the key.
When you speak about political wind, wins, do you see things changing, for example, as we see more states talk about legalization of recreational marijuana, for example, in D.C., there are still many, many laws that need to be adhered to, but 10 years ago, you could get arrested if you had even a small amount of marijuana, and you could very well end up in the system. But now, when small amounts of recreational marijuana, for example, in D.C. are legal, does that change how the bail bond system is dealt with here?
I think it can. I mean, I think, you know, my home state of Colorado, not only is it legal, it's, you know, encouraged to help the tax base. Mm-hmm. And you go in the South and you have any amount of marijuana and all of a sudden you're a felon. So that would have an impact on the bail industry. But as I tell people, you know, if you're going to eliminate crimes, things that shouldn't be crimes, we can't argue with that. If that's the right public policy. And frankly, a lot of things need to be decriminalized. We have a lot of low-level crimes out there, and legislators and policymakers just think, oh, we'll make it a crime, and then they won't do it. But that doesn't work, and we know that. And that's really these nuisance crimes of people that, you know, can get 20 misdemeanors over a lifetime, and it really doesn't change their behavior at all. And those are things we need to look at.
We're going to be back in a few minutes to talk about what are some of the possible solutions. We are talking about the bail bond system and what does reform look like. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment.
Virgin.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about the bail bond system and how reform may look. My guests are Jeffrey Clayton, Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition, and Antoine Washington, owner of Washington and Gray Bail Bonds here in the D.C. Metro. Lines are still open if you have a comment or a question at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jeffrey, I want to go back to you. One could argue, we were talking a little bit about the politicization of this bail bonds issue, where some would argue that reform has been the bailiwick of the left, while conservatives may still have a lock 'em up mentality. Do you believe that is true, or do you believe that there may be some kind of middle ground between the left and the right on this issue?
I think both things are true. I think mostly the push for bail reform has come from the left. Ironically, you know, when the federal system was implemented, the push came from the right. When Ronald Reagan was president, and the ACLU said to enact a system of preventative detention was not only unconstitutionally, but it was morally wrong, something that Thurgood Marshall wrote in the dissent of the U.S. v. Salerno opinion. But I think there's opportunities to work here. And I think the number one answer, as Steve Harvey would say, is using bail as a collections mechanism. We see that all across the country, where cutting out bail bondsmen because you don't like them just fuels the courts and system's thirst for cash. And they keep people's bail money. And so in many states, they're funding entire court systems on this. In New Orleans, a federal lawsuit came out saying that the system was unconstitutional because the judge was setting bail to basically line the coffers and fund the court. And that's wrong. So I think, you know, it is politicized right now. I think we need to depoliticize it like everything else in America and just get together and start putting solutions together, because there's plenty of things to work on this issue, believe me.
But, Antoine, the reality is this is a business.
It is.
This is how you make a living. Some people may find it necessary. Some people may think that it is not a good thing, for lack of a better term. What impact do you believe that some sweeping reforms may have on your ability to make a living?
Well, to be honest with you, Harold, be very honest with you, I do agree in some cases the bills are excessive, right? First and foremost, if I said something otherwise, I'd be lying. I'd be not telling the truth. I've seen them give someone who's unemployed, living in someone's basement, no transportation, give them $15,000 bond, right? Well, they need $1,500 to get out. And somehow, some cousin or some neighbor or some friend walks into my office with $500-$600 as a down payment, and they go into a payment arrangement with me, and maybe in 2 weeks they have the balance paid off.
Wow, I didn't realize that they could do even payment arrangements. Yeah, okay,
that's unfair. But I'm not going to. It's a business. I'm not going to say I'm not going to take your money, because if I don't, my neighbor will. So I just, and I'll say, wow, this guy's homeless. He don't even have transportation. He's not even working. $1,500. But what do you want me to do? It's a business, right? So then you have another guy that works. He's married. Has transportation. His bond may be 2,500, 10% to the court. You see that? 10% to the, where he pay his and get it back. But the guy that's living in his friend's basement and can't even, using public transportation, he had to scrape all his money up that he would not get back just to get out of jail. Mm-hmm. So
based on your experience, some people could argue, we've heard the old saying, crime doesn't pay, but in your case, it pays.
Yeah, right. It's a business. It's a business.
It is a business, and business. I'm not making light of it, but... It is obviously...
By no means is any bail bonds taking advantage of its clients. They get arrested, they call us. Period.
They need you.
There you go. We're not you know, taking advantage of anyone. We didn't commit the crime. We didn't charge them. We didn't... How they ended up where they ended up is on their own, right? Mm-hmm. They called us and say... When I say us, it's a community of bail bonds. They called ABC or Acme Bail Bonds or Washington Great Bail Bonds because they needed my help, right? They called me. I helped him. He's out of jail. It's a business.
As you look back over the more than 20 years that you've been doing this, what is it in your mind that in the example that you use, which often determines... Algorithm notwithstanding, what will determine whether or not somebody gets a low or a high bail?
It's subjective. No one knows. It depends on the attorney. It depends on your criminal history. It depends on a ton of factors. There's no like set guidelines that okay, Harold Fisher, date of birth this, education this, single, $5,000. It doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. It just all depends on, you know, the luck of the draw.
So, Jeffrey, I want to bring this particular issue because we were kind of throwing this issue around today, even in the newsroom, in the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case. Initially, George Zimmerman was set free, but after all of the politics and publicity, he eventually had a $1 million bond set. And because of the publicity and people donating to the cause, he was able to make bond. But that was a Stand Your Ground case. Now we have another Stand Your Ground case. Michael Draca accused of shooting a black man over a dispute about a handicapped parking space. Yesterday, his bond was set at $100,000. Talk to me about that. Is this politics? Is this political pressure? Is this about publicity? Why would not a Michael Draca get a $1 million bond?
It definitely has an impact, and I think it's an unconstitutional impact. It's not one of the factors that the community is going to be outraged or that there's community outrage. And it's wrong. And that's unfortunate because you're right. Judges read the newspaper, too. And when they see themselves on TV, it changes the outcome. And that's bad. We would advocate against that. So I think, unfortunately, publicity does have an impact. And the Stand Your Ground cases are just tough cases in general, more so than if it was like a premeditated murder or a case like that, because those are snap-second decisions. But you're right, publicity has a major impact on it, which I would argue is both wrong and unconstitutional.
In these last few minutes, I want to talk about possible solutions. And I'll start with you, Jeffrey. Your thoughts on what should be the first best steps to reforming the bail bonds system?
Well, what we're looking at mostly is individual determination because of the arbitrariness of it, as we've heard on this program, and that the fact that judges don't have time to look at it. Prosecutors don't have time to look at it. Even the public defenders are completely overburdened. They don't have time to look at it. And when I was an attorney, you know, the senior partner told me, we call Joe Beanie the bail bondsman if we have a bail problem. Well, that's just not good enough anymore. The other thing is, I think this is 2018. Things in the criminal justice system move entirely too slow. From trial to bail, even after the posting of bail, we've seen cases where bail's posted, and in one case, in a large metropolitan jail, they lost the guy for 30 hours. That can't happen in modern America, and we need to make the process quicker and more individualized. And I think those are kind of the general themes of the reforms, you know, that we're working on. And certainly, you know, to reduce the use of monetary bail in appropriate cases, and some cases where it is appropriate, you know, to use it, and to change the mix, I think, a little bit, is what other folks are looking at.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts about reform, Antoine, without negatively impacting your business. Does this start at the bench? Does this start with access to better legal services? Or something else that I don't know about?
I agree with my man, what
Jeffrey
just said.
Was saying.
Yeah, I agree with him 100%. And I just think people should, when I see people, the court, the judiciary system, they should stop looking at the bail bondsman as the enemy. We assist. We help. We make sure people return to court. If someone missed court, right, and you say you out on just promises to come back, right, just a personal recognizance. If you miss court, and you issued a warrant for your arrest, right, all that happens is a sheriff's going to come to your last known address. He's going to knock on the door. If you don't answer, he's going to leave. A bail bondsman is not going to go away that easy. If you out on bail and you miss court, a bail bondsman will hunt you down. Yes, he will hunt you down in any state that you are, whether you're in the local area, whether you're in California, anywhere that you are, he's going to get you. He's going to bring you all the way back to the jurisdiction that you wanted in. Bail bondsmen, we help the court system. We help people show back up for court because we go out looking for people. Sheriffs, they don't do that.
Interesting. I want to thank both of you, Jeffrey Clayton and Antoine Washington, for coming in and having this conversation
with us. Girl.
Certainly, a lot to think about, not only in this area, but state to state, and we will certainly keep watching. Again, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141 for this Tuesday, August 14th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.